What will I be like as a parent? What am I like as a parent? Am I doing the right thing? Am I ready for this? Am I getting it right? Will I get it right? What should I be doing? Am I doing it? Oh, yes, the cacophony of thoughts that race through a prospective or first-time parent's head. You might have been there. Remember that feeling? Perhaps it's ongoing, perhaps it never ends, or you've watched friends go through it all. Many of these doubts that parents are plagued with, particularly as they're gestating their first child, well, they may well be age-old worries, but what is new, Zoe Williams argues, is a certain kind of madness of modern parenting. The madness of modern parenting is the title of her new essay, just published in what's called the Provocation series. Zoe's a columnist with the Guardian newspaper in the UK, and she joined me a little earlier on the line, and I welcomed her to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. You're a sharp-eyed observer of modern life. You're also the parent of two young children. So why are you attaching this word madness to modern parenting?
Well, what I noticed when I got pregnant the first time, which was 8 years ago now, was that there were a number of risks portrayed as attached with your behaviour in parenting that just didn't seem biologically very plausible. So, for instance, you could at that point, they were very against raw fish, they were very against the cheeses, the alcohol, the anti-alcohol movement in pregnancy, it really gathered steam. And it just seemed to me completely unlikely, given the kind of epidemiological evidence of the past 300 years, that these things were as dangerous as we were being told they were.
Okay, and so you think that we've catapulted ourselves into an era of madness with those recommendations?
Well, it's not so much with those recommendations per se, but what I notice all around the place is an environment, a kind of advice environment and a policy environment and a social environment in which a tiny piece of risk is unacceptable to a pregnant person, anybody carrying a baby. So you might say, well, hang on a second. This baby, it's going to be the most precious thing ever. Often new mothers don't realize how much they're going to love their baby until it's actually out. So I know I didn't. You know, we deserve to be told and to have the risks really underlined because we don't know how we're going to feel if things go wrong. But the truth is that there is no such thing as a completely zero risk environment. So you would never, for instance, say to a pregnant woman, this is the speed limit at which you can drive in order not to injure yourself in the event of a crash, even though, you know, she might well crash a car, pregnant women do, because we accept the kind of inherent risks of driving as the price we pay for living in the kind of normal world. Now, you can say that those risks aren't acceptable and we shouldn't accept them, but the fact is that we do accept them. What we don't accept is anything that a woman might do or come into contact with, which she perceives herself or society perceives her as having some control over. So, you know, you pregnant woman, you're not supposed now to buy new furniture while you're pregnant in case there's a kind of chemical contamination. You're not supposed to buy new saucepans. You're not supposed to come into contact with all these kind of chemical treatments. And my feeling is very much that, A, there is no such thing as a risk-free pregnancy. And when we kind of try and create one, what we do is throw onto the mother responsibility for genetic and biological accidents that are mostly not her fault. And B, we're creating a kind of individuated perception of risk where the responsible person can do everything to prevent it. Well, yes, now that's just not true.
Well, communicating risk is a very complicated thing, really, as we know. You illustrate how far some women have taken their concerns in this essay. Some people abort the fetus because of the concern about their behaviour beforehand. Just talk to that.
I mean, this is just a really extraordinary thing. And actually, since we had anecdotal evidence of this, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service has put together some data showing that women are coming in asking for abortions because they're so panicked about the drinking they did in their earliest weeks of pregnancy when they didn't know they were pregnant. Mm. Now, the truth of it is, we have good epidemiological evidence about what alcohol does to fetuses above a certain amount. But that amount is a lot, right? So we've got little to no evidence of harm at medium to low levels of drinking, and sound evidence of harm at very high levels of drinking. So, you know, anybody can tell you, whether they're a doctor or a journalist or an epidemiologist, don't be an alcoholic. But the idea that if you kind of accidentally drank lightly, not knowing you were pregnant, and that's reason enough to have an abortion, is really, really a symbol of how far we've come down this kind of very extreme, kind of risk-free dream. Where, you know, our kind of, we think of ourselves as being able to be perfect vessels for our babies, which we can't.
Yeah, it's an illustration of incredible anxiety amongst women today. Nevertheless, in our own country, the National Health and Medical Research Council guidelines around alcohol use during pregnancy and breastfeeding say, for women who are pregnant or planning a pregnancy, not drinking is the safest option. For women who are breastfeeding, not drinking is the safest option. So they're our official guidelines.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I had this argument with the Department of Health, which is our official body, who say exactly the same thing. But their official guidelines our line is, for women who are trying to get pregnant or who are pregnant already, don't know alcohol, or no more than 2 units twice a week. Now that, A, it doesn't make any sense as a guideline. You've either got a no alcohol guideline or you've got a some alcohol guideline. You can't have a no alcohol or a some alcohol guideline, because that's not a guideline.
Right? Well, ours says no alcohol is best.
But you have to ask them what they're basing that on, because total abstention would have to have some kind of scientific basis, right? There would be no point in having a guideline to which you couldn't point to the evidence, except that you actually can't point to the evidence for this. And we have, as I say, quite a lot of evidence about high levels of harm, but none at all about levels of harm at very low levels of drinking. So then you say, well, why are you preaching total abstention if you've got no evidence of harm at low levels? And very often the answer comes back, well, women tend not to be very good estimators of how much a unit is. I've genuinely seen that in a policy document. So because we can't,
and you don't think that's a valid point?
Well, no. I mean, you can't give somebody false information on the basis that they won't be able to look it up if you give them correct information. You either have to say to them, have 1 unit a day, or you have to say to them, have no units on this basis. But you can't say, we know it's safe to have this much, but because you won't estimate it properly, you shouldn't have anything. Because that's really infantilizing. I mean, that's treating the women themselves as babies.
Yes, that's an interesting point you make about what message that does send to women.
Yeah, you're not in charge of making these adjudications yourself, so we have to overstate a risk in order for you to stay within the margin of risk. Now, the other thing they often say is that we've got no evidence of zero harm at any level. And there's an economist called Emily Oster, who's American, who said, well, you know, you've got no evidence of zero harm of, like, the number of bananas you can eat to have no potassium effect. You've got no evidence of zero harm to how close you could live to a freeway and have no effect on asthma. You actually can't expect statistics to give you evidence of zero harm, because that's not what statistics do.
Zoe Williams is our guest on Life Matters this morning. She's a writer and columnist with The Guardian newspaper. She's author of an essay called The Madness of Modern Parenting out in Australia. So, Zoe, does this mean that you helped yourself to as much brie on toast as you could during your own pregnancies?
The thing is, I got pregnant. I didn't realise I was pregnant with my second child until I was 18 weeks gone. You know, when you go for a scan and it's always tiny and you can't see it, and then you get upset. It's like a plot from Friends. When I went for a scan with my second child, she was honestly the size of a puppy.
It was very present.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, I'm pregnant.
I know. When I went to the doctor, I was like, oh, good grief, you know, because I'd only just realized that morning that this is what had happened. And I went along and she said, well, I can already feel the baby, which means you're definitely over 3 months. And I was just shaking with anxiety. And in that instance, obviously, unwittingly, I had eaten some very weird things, because I'm also a food critic.
So I'd had a squirrel Ballantine.
A what?
A squirrel. It's like a kind of pate made of squirrel.
Oh my God!
I know. I mean, it was.
Well, really, there's definitely no evidence to support the consumption of squirrels during pregnancy.
I think you would definitely be warned to stay away from vermin. But you know, so actually, I wasn't really preaching what I believed in the end, because I was so anxious having behaved like this for 18 weeks and then found out I was pregnant. But then I did overestimate my own risks. You know, in the dark night of Nordic soul, I was thinking, oh, and then I ate this, and then I ate that, and then I ate bagged salad, and how would I possibly know? And she doesn't seem to be kicking. And, you know, I did really wind myself up into a state of intense anxiety, to the extent that I can understand why women do go for these kind of preventative abortions, just because they're so convinced that their own behavior will have that much effect on the birth.
The issue with soft cheeses, of course, is the risk of listeriosis, and you have a lot to say about this too.
Well, I mean, this is very interesting. I often get a very classic response from this, which is instances of listeriosis do occur. Every irresponsible person like you kind of contributes to the death of those fetuses. And the reason I don't think it's valid, that point, is that very often it's not from a soft cheese. It's not from anything you could avoid. It's from contamination in a factory of a foodstuff that you would never know that you were ingesting. Or it's from one. There was a famous outbreak in America of a homemade Mexican cheese that had then been used as a garnish in a restaurant. Now, there's no risk factor on earth that can prevent you eating a homemade Mexican cheese.
Well, but the thing is that, prospective mothers are going to say, "Look, I'll do my very best to minimise the risk." And therefore, I'll just avoid soft cheese during my pregnancy. Surely that is an easy thing to do. Why have a go at it?
Well, it's easy, but what it doesn't do is really change the reality for people getting listeriosis. And what it does instead is make women feel like anything negative that befalls their fetus is their fault. Now, so my point is, if listeriosis does exist, although, may I say, in extremely small numbers, so, you know, I was told by a midwife that I might well have given my baby listeriosis that morning, or that I could have given my baby listeriosis and not known it. Actually, the chances of that happening, you're talking about 5 or 6 cases a year in the UK, and none of which have ever been traced back to soft cheese. So the first problem is the overstatement of risk. The second problem is the over-allocation of responsibility. And I think that leaves women with very little support when something does go wrong, because all the perception is that they did it to themselves.
I just want to touch on another point you make in this essay, The Madness of Modern Parenting, and that is, in the UK, you received a health in pregnancy grant.
Oh, yeah.
About which you are very cynical. What was that grant and what did you do with it?
Well, so I received £190. So this was before the coalition government came in, right? So we actually, the universal benefits were quite generous. But what, £190 would actually, if you gave the poorest 10% of mothers £1,900, you could do something really quite amazing. You know, that would be enough for them to move out of a damp flat and get the deposit on a not damp flat, or to buy proper equipment, or to just have a bit more time off. I mean, in the hands of really poor mothers, that could make the difference between having 3 months with your baby and having 9 months with your baby. Instead, what they did was they gave it to all mothers. They gave £190 to all mothers on the basis that if we ate fresh fruit and vegetables, our fetuses would be healthier. Now, this simply is not backed up by the evidence. There is evidence that mothers who have a very healthy diet have less obesity in their children as they get older. But it's not, it's certainly not as causal as I ate carrots in pregnancy, therefore I've got a lovely lean child. It's much more likely to be something epigenetic, in which, you know, a lifetime's good diet gives you a lifetime's good health, which you then pass on to your child. It's the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which are acquired over generations. And to try and rectify that with £190, which you tell mothers to spend on vegetables, but they probably won't. I mean, I know I didn't.
Zoe Williams, the sort of response we get from listeners to conversations critiquing the whole modern parenting thing and anxiety is, well, what do you expect us to do? You know, are you having a go at newbie parents in making this case?
I used to hate new mothers because they always look so, they used to look so dozy, you know, they're always moving so slowly and staring. But now I really get, I mean, you know, babies are like cigarettes. Once you've had one, you always want another one, really. And, you know, I find the whole state completely delightful. And I would never blame a new mother for anything, even if she was the most neurotic person ever. But I do think we've got a real problem. And I think this is really well illustrated by the whole debate around chemicals in furniture and in frying pans. The RCOG, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, came out with a report that said, we can't find any evidence that these chemicals don't harm fetuses, but just in case they do, stay away from all this stuff. Now, there's a corporate case to answer. It's very like saying, we can't find evidence that diesel fumes do give you asthma, but just in case they do, don't live near a bus route. You have to say at some point, this is not my responsibility anymore. This is the responsibility of society, either to deal with the chemicals that we use to preserve Teflon or to deal with the fumes from buses. These things that we produce as a society, we need to deal with as a society. And to say, to try and throw that back onto individual mothers who, let's face it, already have enough to worry about, is completely wrong.
What's been the response to your argument? Because some would say you're a journo. You're not a health researcher. You're not a scientist. No. You're not a risk specialist.
It's funny. I mean, the breastfeed, I get worse response from breastfeeding than I do about absolutely anything else. And that's the case on which the science is the weakest. So there's really good evidence that breastfeeding protects against gastrointestinal disease. And the mechanism for that is well known. You know, we know the hormone that protects. We know how it gets from the mother to the milk. We know how it gets from the milk to the baby. That's completely straightforward. All the rest of the evidence is completely confounded by, as the sociologist Joan Wolfe says, we've never found a way to distinguish between the breastfeeding and the decision to breastfeed. So it's so confounded with class and the type of person you are, how educated you are, how hygienic you are. There are so many other factors that we cannot actually boil down what it is about breastfeeding that would protect you against cancer or an ear infection or make your IQ go up or any of the claims that are made for breastfeeding. We simply cannot find the scientific basis for them. Now, I don't need to be a scientist or a risk specialist to say that. All I need to be is a literate person who can read books. And if somebody can show me the test that has kind of removed all these confounding factors, then obviously I'm prepared to be wrong. I don't want to be right. I want everybody to be happy. I don't want me to be right. But it's very, very like, and I think the comparison is salient. When you try and talk about the economy, you often get kind of, you're just a journalist. You're not an economist. You're not a banker. You haven't got a maths degree. And I sort of want to say, look, if a literate person isn't allowed to discuss this, then you're not allowed to tell literate people what to do, because we have to be involved in the conversation. We're all in it.
Yes. Well, with that provocation, we are now going to hear from the great breastfeeding community across Australia and indeed the world. Zoe Williams, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning, and thanks for the essay. It is provocative. I think people will be very interested to read it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
UK journalist and columnist Zoe Williams joining us a little earlier. Her essay, The Madness of Modern Parenting, is published in Australia through Black Bite Publishing. It's part of what's called the Provocations series. And yes, Zoe, as ever, if you read her columns in The Guardian, is here to provoke. So we'd love to hear from you on the Life Matters Facebook page right now if you're just champing at the bit to say something, and also on the Peter Martin discussion about whether or not companies should pay zero tax.